the Simply Focus with Elfie Czerny and Dominic Gilda for Life and Joy and Ease.
Welcome back to the Simply Focus podcast, The Good Life Approach, your podcast for life in joy and ease. My name is Elfie Czerny.
And I'm Dominic Gilda. Hi there.
We are super excited to sit here with Heather Fisk today. Hello, Heather, and thank you for having us with you.
Hi, Elfie, and thank you so much. I'm excited to be part of this wonderful series.
We've been here for a couple of days and it's so beautiful. If we look out of the window, we see the ocean and the beach and just a lovely garden with the grass and three chairs there to sit and just relax and watch into the blue.
Heather is an amazing cook. She is an amazing host. She is an amazing grandmother, which we can also see in the way how she is with Bibiana.
And she's so much fun.
The two of you are so much fun. And Heather is also a solution-focused practitioner for over 45 years now.
A practitioner, only solution-focused for the last 25 years.
25 years. Mm-hmm. Well, only for 25 years. <so. laughs> She did amazing work in the field of suicide prevention, wrote a book about hope in action, solution-focused conversation about suicide. And we are very excited to talk with you today about all your work and the precious things you brought into this world over the last 25 and even more years.
Okay.
So to start with, what fascinates you with solution focus?
Oh, so many things. And I think early on when I first encountered solution focused, I was actively looking for briefer ways of working because I was working in a hospital where we had very limited resources and many, many, many referrals. And I mostly worked with adolescents there. And so we were getting between 60 and 90 referrals every month. And there were three of us on our team. And we were all trained to do long-term psychotherapy and long assessments before any psychotherapy. And so we had these kids sitting waiting on the waiting list, and many of them had already made suicide attempts. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of troubling, serious issues, and I couldn't stand that. It was not acceptable. So I went looking for two things. One was help, and the other was other ways to work, right? Mm-hmm. So that we could be more efficient. And then, of course, I went to a workshop with Insoo Kim Berg in Toronto around, I think it was 1988, and I thought, yes, this is really interesting. This can work. But more than that, and I think you've heard this before from some of my colleagues and some of your colleagues, I felt like I'd come home. Mm-hmm. It was like, yes, this is where I want to be. I mean, this is going to let me practice what I preach. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what was it that made you feel coming home?
So one of the things is going to sound silly, but Insoo had been on a long flight from maybe Asia, I don't know, and she just arrived and she was tired and stiff. And so as she began the workshop, she was doing her yoga on the stage while she was talking to us to stretch out and get limber. And I thought, oh, flexibility, how wonderful. This is what we need, more flexibility in our work. So that was silly. But also just from the beginning, you know, I think I don't know anybody who works in mental health, for example, who wouldn't say, oh, I want to be respectful of my clients or patients. But this was respect you could see, right, and act it. And of course, one of the things she says, said is that we ask questions as an articulation of respect. We don't assume. Right? So we must ask questions and find out from you. And so that whole enactment of respect and the many, many ways, implicit and explicit, that she and you and other solution-focused practitioners treat the client as the expert, and just watching the amazing things that clients do because of that. I mean, I'm kind of addicted to that bit, you know, to just waiting to see what they're going to do and say and all the ways that people find to go on and make a good moment and a good day and a good life in spite of all the pain and trouble.
So not assuming, asking questions as articulation of respect. Wow.
So Heather, how did your work change then after you met Insu for the first time?
Well, massively. You know, as I said, I've been trained in very, very different ways of working. So some of it was about really learning and practicing constructive listening. So, you know, many kinds of strength-based practice, I think, would do this. But that makes such a difference. And of course, one of the things I've noticed and one of the things that still fascinates me is how this makes a difference for our clients in terms of what we notice, what we respond to, identify, highlight, reinforce for them, the strengths, the resources, the successes, all that good stuff. But also how it makes a difference for me, mm-hmm. right? And I think it's one of the key reasons that I'm still doing this mm-hmm. and that I have no plans ever to retire. And I always say, I think if I hadn't discovered solution-focused practice long ago, then I would be doing something else by now. You know, I probably would have burned out, got tired, whatever, moved on.
Fortunately, you didn't.
No. And I think it's because, you know, you're so attuned to be looking for those things. And it means I'm lighter at the end of the day. It means I have more confidence in my clients because I'm always watching and tracking all the things they are able to do in spite of all the crap. I'm looking at their histories in terms of what they have survived and learned and what they're still able to do. And so it means I can stay hopeful. And the research says that clients who believe that their helpers have hope for them have better outcomes. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important. I think to me that means that I have a professional responsibility mm-hmm. to stay hopeful and to think about how that gets communicated to my clients. Mm. So I don't think that means that every time a new person comes through my door, I jump up and shake their hands and say, wow, you look like a really hopeful case to me. I think it's much more implicit in the way that I work and the kind of conversations that we have and the things I'm interested in about them.
So really hope in action, like the title of your book.
Yeah, yeah. And also it's about the way that we are interested in preferred futures. You know, the possibilities that you see for yourself when we look beyond what is happening now. You know, we use the miracle question, suppose questions, all these techniques, but it's all about wanting them to have an experience, a glimpse or a sense of how things can be when they are past this current trouble. And I think that is one of the things that is unique about solution-focused practice. There are many useful things that we share with other ways of working, but I think the way that we work with the future is absolutely unique and so powerful. And Yvonne Dolan, from whom I have stolen so many useful ideas and practices, thank you, Yvonne, would say that people pay attention not just to what we say, but to what we don't say. So, for example, if you saw one of my clients, she might say to me, you know, I saw that psychologist and she didn't even ask me about this or that or the other. And if we don't ask people about their futures and aren't interested in what they want and what they see ahead, then they may think we don't think that is important or they don't have a future or it's a terrible future. So there are messages we give, I think, by not being interested in that and even more powerfully by being interested in that.
I know a lot of people who say, well, if people come with suicidal thoughts, I don't want to ask them about their future because I'm afraid that they might say I'm not there anymore.
Right. So if that's what they're thinking, I need to know, right? I need to know. Safety first, right? And so if that's the answer, then I'm going to, of course, have some more conversation. And one of the things I'm going to do is ask, oh, this reminds me of a story. But I'm going to ask the standard solution-focused follow-up questions. Mm-hmm. And if I say, so how will it be better for you mm-hmm. if you're not there? Then often I hear about something like, oh, then it just won't hurt all the time, or I won't be afraid, or I won't feel like I'm doing such a terrible job of being a parent or a child or a spouse or whatever it is. And so then we can inquire about how they would like that to be different, because that's the beginning of something they want to be different. Mm. And from where they are, maybe all they can see as a solution is to end their lives. But this is a place I think a but is okay. In general, I try to avoid buts. But what they're looking for, the problem they're trying to solve, is not about ending their life. It's about something that's not working, something they need, and they are in such a state that they cannot see other possibilities. So Insoo Kimberg used to describe solution-focused questions as a tap on the shoulder, and I really think they are. One of the things you often hear after a death by suicide is, oh my goodness, she had so much to live for, or he had things going for him. He was going to be able to get back on track. But in that state, those people did not see it. And they couldn't see their reasons for living. They couldn't see hope. So we can say, okay, so what would your best friend say about this? And those relationship questions, you know, it's uncanny how powerful they are, really. I mean, the best friend's not there. The person may have said, I see nothing, I know nothing, I can't think of anything. But if you ask it in that way, sometimes they'll say, well, you know, my best friend would say that I can pull out of this and that he's seen me go through tough stuff before and, you know, manage to cope. Oh, well, let's hear more about that. Yeah.
When we talk about hope in action, we actually don't only talk about the people who think of suicide, but yes, also about the support system. And you had some beautiful stories of also how to support the supporters. And I would love to hear a little bit more about that from you.
Okay, so I don't know which particular stories you had in mind, but here's something that comes to me. So I'll talk about this and you can tell me if you want me to talk about something else. So when I was sort of struggling to find, you know, a better way to work with my adolescent clients and their families in the hospital I worked in the 80s and 90s, one of the things that I did, because I could see that all these kids and families were sitting on our waiting list, and it was the parents who were kind of, the expression we have is left holding the bag, and it was overwhelming for them and terrifying for them often. So I thought, maybe since they're the ones who are trying to keep these kids safe and on track, we can offer something for them to back them up a little bit. And so this is embarrassing, but what I did was I decided to offer a psychoeducational program just once a month, one evening. It was what I could do, right? 3-hour program. And I called it Psychoeducational Program for Parents of Suicidal Adolescents. I'm embarrassed by that now. I'm really embarrassed by that now. So what's really amazing to me is that parents came to that thing, right? Because I think that as a parent, it's one of the most painful things and frightening things a parent can face, that your child who you love so much is in such distress that they want to end their life. They want to die. That's just awful for a parent. And I think it's very natural for a parent to want to run as fast as they can away from that and to walk through a door that has that label on it. What was I thinking? But they came anyway. And initially I had this idea about doing sort of formal psychoeducation, and I showed them slides, you know, about suicide risk and warning signs and what to do and where to go for help. And I gave them handouts because I think it's good to have something concrete. I still think that. I would not give those same handouts. But I realized I also was beginning to learn solution focused as this process went on. And so things changed. First of all, I realized that the most important thing, more than anything I said or did, information I gave them or encouragement, that they were doing some really positive things and that their support was so important, much more important than any of that, was they walked through the door and they saw these other parents who also had children who are in this terrible state. And none of these people had horns or fangs. You know, they were all good people doing their best for their kids and caring enough about their kids to walk through a door with that sign on it. And that was the most powerful thing. And in any group situation, I think that's often the most powerful thing. The second most powerful thing was that I don't have horns or fangs. And so for a lot of people, it's difficult and scary to become involved with the mental health system. And I was part of that system. And to entrust your child to it is very scary. Much easier, as I said, to run away. And parents often hear negative stories, and those are real. So I think it was important that I was there and I was respectful and kindly. And so maybe when they needed help down the road, it would not be quite as difficult to get help for their kids. So over time, you know, I looked at the sign on the door and I thought, oh my gosh. And so I changed it to, I can't remember exactly, you know, something about parents helping their kids or something like that. And then down the road, I talked with the parents and said, what should we call this? What's a good title for it? And so we ended up calling it What Parents Can Do.
Oh, right? Wow.
So, you know, I did it for many years, and then someone I'd worked with took it and carried it on. So we called it What Parents Can Do, and that was the focus. And, you know, it went from me presenting all this information and slides about risk and warning signs to, from the beginning, talking about what parents can do and how important that is, and asking them what they're already doing that's making a difference for their kid, what their kid would say they do that is important and that they want them to keep doing, these kinds of questions, and inviting them to talk with each other about that, and inviting them to what I would now think of as resource gossip about what they hear from each other in the room. That was a really long answer.
What a beautiful story. I haven't heard this one, so I'm excited to have heard this one now as well, especially good. From the change of title, from how you called it this embarrassing title to What Parents Can Do. Mm-hmm. This is really powerful.
Mm-hmm. Also, we got complaints. I want to say this. I always got complaints about that group because we laughed too loud. There were other psychoeducational programs going on in the building, in the rooms nearby, and we laughed too loud. Wow. I love that complaint.
Yeah.
So parents that came into a room with the idea of having suicidal kids laughed too loud in the workshop. Wow.
Mm, yeah.
This reminds me of a story or of a title, Reasons for Living, a very kind of strong focus that we had in our webinar that we did on Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Reasons for Living. How do you incorporate this focus or this idea in your work with either parents or kids that feel suicidal?
So, you know, because I was dealing with so many suicidal kids, and because, like many mental health professionals, I had had no training in suicide prevention, none. It's crazy. It's getting a little better now, but still... Anyway, still not enough. And of course, the training that was out there at the time, it's changing slowly now, was very, very focused on assessment. It's still very focused on that. And in particular, looking at risk factors and warning signs. And if you look at the literature on suicide prevention, then there are literally tens of thousands of studies. We have a huge evidence base on risk factors. Really, all of us are walking bundles of risk factors, right? It's really not helpful to know that there are these thousands and thousands of things that can be a risk for suicide. Warning signs is a bit better, but the most valid and reliable thing we can do is just ask the client about where they are and what's happening with them. And I think about Reasons for Living, I think it's a really useful conversation, helpful to the client, but also, and it's a big tap on the shoulder to talk about that, because, you know, in suicide prevention, they talk about cognitive constriction. It's like the person has blinders on. All they see is shit. You know, Ed Schneidman, the father of American suicidology, once said that being depressed is like looking at the world through shit-colored glasses. And it's a very apt description. And so they're unable to see the rest. And we need to invite them to consider some of that, because they can't do that for themselves to make that shift. So it's something we can really help with by the nature of our questions and what we are paying attention to in our conversations. And we can help to rebalance a conversation so that it's not just about your particular risk factors and what it is that is driving you or pulling you toward suicide, but that it also includes information about what would be driving or pulling you toward life and toward going forward.
This is what I love about the tap on the shoulder, because a tap is a kind of connection we make if we tap on the shoulder. So we connect to another human being. And this is also what I see, what we do in our conversations and through our questions, through the way we listen, connecting with each other as humans and also connecting to preferred futures, to what works in our lives, to all the resources that are there, and this is the beauty of solution focused.
I think so. And some of the particulars of solution focused, I mean, I saw it as a helpful method from the beginning. Over the years, I've come to feel more and more that there is a particularly good fit between solution focused practice and working with people who are seeing suicide as an option. Sometimes the only option. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that. And one has, again, to do with this thing about the future. You know, we have very good tools and habits for inviting people to think about how things could be different and what it will be like for them when things are different. And that's key because, you know, the literature says people who are in that state aren't able to do that for themselves, right? They're stuck. They can't see a future. I mean, it's the nature of it. And so it's one of the particular reasons that that is helpful. And also the miracle question for for many people who are in that place makes so much sense, right? Because not always, one size fits one. There's no one size fits all. But for many people that I talk to, they think that it would take a miracle to change things for them. So the question really fits. And also, you know, the best hopes question that I often begin with. Thank you to the folks at Brief in London for that. What are your best hopes for this conversation? That fits too. It goes right to the heart of the matter, right from the very beginning. You know, do I have any hopes? And if I have hopes, what might they be?
And maybe for our listeners who are not that much into solution focus, how do you ask the miracle question, or what are some examples of you asking the miracle question in the situation?
Yeah. So, you know, one of the things about solution focused practice is that the miracle question is an unusual question in any context. And I always start by saying, you know, I want to ask you this weird question. Would that be okay? This is a question I find helps me to really get a better handle on what it is you want or what would be helpful to you. And so far, they always say yes, I can ask. Or they say, is it weirder than the questions you've been asking me so far? And I say, well, maybe. I also think by introducing the question, we get their attention. And that's important. Insoo Kimberg used to always say, you know, if we're going to help someone change, first we have to get their attention. And then it's an unusual question because I introduce it. And all of the other things we ask people come out of what they say. We're building on what they say to us and following them. This is something we bring in. There are signals that tell us, I think, that it's a good time to ask it. So suppose someone has been talking about seeing no way out. I would say to them, suppose that after we finish this conversation we're having today, you carry on with the rest of your day, whatever it is you had planned, and eventually tonight you go to sleep. And let's just say that tonight you have a really deep, restful sleep. And while you're sleeping, a miracle happens. And the miracle is that somehow you begin to see just the beginning of another way, just the beginning, the possibility of some other way. But there's always a but, right? But because you're sleeping, you don't know that this miracle has happened. So tomorrow morning, after you wake up, even before you open your eyes, what's the first small thing you might notice that will tell you something's different?
Wow, thank you. I love the detail and the tiny, tiny little step, the beginning, just the beginning of a possibility. Thank you. Heather, I'm also curious how the book title Hope in Action came up for you.
Okay, so the action part, I mean, it's an expression we use in English, hope in action, putting certain things into action. You know, that's forgiveness in action, that's optimism in action, that's you know, something in action. But also Steve DeShazer, the action part definitely comes from him. And that was so helpful to me because, as I think Janet Bavala said in the podcast you did with her, and talk about people I have stolen wonderful, useful things from. She's very high on that list. Anyway, Jen said, you know, that there's so much focus on thinking and the mind in the strategies, and not all, but that it's important to include doing. So in the last book that Steve wrote with a group of colleagues, More Than Miracles, he talked about the importance of getting up details that include what people are thinking, feeling, and doing, right? And in order to really create useful pathways and possibilities. So the action part definitely is from Steve. The hope part is from my clients because it's what I see that makes the difference. And I think about one of my suicide prevention colleagues, Paul, whose last name escapes me at this moment. He wrote a wonderful book that's available as a free download online. He gave it to the world, called Counseling Suicidal People, A Therapy of Hope. So he talks a lot about this tiny molecule of hope, and that when you ask people about what was useful in a conversation, they often talk about this tiny molecule of hope. You know, one of my clients used to say, okay, maybe there's a little light at the end of the tunnel that isn't a train. Yeah. And also, I think more and more, I think it's one of the most useful things that we can do to help people find that, as opposed to construct or even co-construct solutions for them, because they do that once they have the hope. Once they see a possibility, they run with it. And they think of things we never could have thought of. The best thing we can do then is get out of the way.
getting out of the way. This is, I think, one of the biggest gifts we can do to other people when they start to talk about what they want, where they want to go, what their dreams are, what their hopes are. Just let them share their beautiful stories.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are two places in life where, for me, I've learned that it is the most useful thing to just be quiet. And certainly one is working with my clients. The other is raising adolescent children.
We still have some time.
Yeah.
Well, sometimes I feel we're in this phase already.
Yeah. It just, yeah.
So Heather, you are also training people in solution focus, and you did the trainer course with Steve and Insu together with Brenda Salter-Minton, actually. I heard a story that you crushed the trainer course in a lovely way.
So when we were learning, and Brenda and I learned together, so we were on the same team at the hospital. We both worked there for a time and still work together whenever we find an opportunity. We live in different parts of a rather large country, but
can't wait to see the two of you in Boulder at the SFBTA conference doing the trainer.
Well, I can't wait either. We had such a good time. It's whenever I work with Brenda, there's this delicious diffusion of responsibility. I have no pressure. It's all going to be fine because Brenda's going to be there. Yeah, so Brenda is my dear friend and colleague, but also with Steve and Insu, they are my primary solution-focused mentors, the three of them. And we are very different, Brenda and I, and I've learned so much from her. I mean, we would go to training in the early days, and, you know, Brenda's an actor, a wonderful actor, and as you know, just juicy. Brenda's just full of life. So we would go to a training, and I would want to sit at the back with my notebook, you know, and take down the names of all the things I should read. And Brenda would be dragging me up to the front and saying, Heather and I will do the role play. It was so useful. It was so useful. And then I worked with her for many years and learned, you know, to be a very different kind of trainer than I would have been on my own. And now when I'm really stuck, if I can't get her on the phone, then I just channel her and figure out something active to do. So, because it's so much more useful than anything else. Anyway, we had gone to a couple of trainings in Milwaukee and went to see Steve and Insu whenever we had a chance when they were in our part of the world. And when we were in Milwaukee doing maybe our second training there, Insu said to us, you know, I have this request for some training in Toronto and I can't go. So I told them they should get you to come. And we said, what? What? Like, oh, wonderful. So, you know, we started doing training. Yeah. And then we started doing a lot of training for our hospital. So both we would have workshops on site and also they would rent us out to other organizations to do solution-focused training. It was like having a paid internship in training. But we had no training in being trainers. And so we saw on the schedule for Steve and Insu's work in Milwaukee that they were going to be offering a training for trainers, but that it would be by invitation only. And we didn't have an invitation. And it was the week before. We just noticed that this was coming. And so we called and said, you know, you didn't invite us, but like you're sending us this training work to do, and we really need to figure out to know more about what we're doing. Can we please come? And they said, oh, sure. And it was really good that they did because there were six people, I think, besides Brenda and me, and they were all men. So it was really important, I think, to have a better gender division. And it was fascinating. And one of the things, I think it's probably what you're thinking about, you probably heard it from Brenda. One of the things they did, and we still do this sometimes, is that they, when we had all worked together for a few days, they invited the group to come up with a sort of training persona that they saw in each person. And Brenda's, of course, was Whoopi Goldberg, which is an excellent fit.
I so much love this. When she told that, I was like, wow, I love that. That's so you.
Yeah, it's great.
I mean, Whoopi Goldberg is so Brenda.
And mine was an American broadcaster who I had never seen, so it wasn't as meaningful, but it's still a fun exercise. And it's really interesting to see, you know, when your colleagues who have observed you learning to train and trying out some of your training chops, when they observe you and then say, okay, here is part of how you impress me. So last year, someone, they said Meryl Streep, and she was overwhelmed. I mean, people are often, it's hard to take that in, but important, useful, I think. It was fun.
Wow.
Yeah.
So we can all look forward to the Train the Trainer course at the SFPTA conference 2018 coming soon.
So Heather, looking back on your solution-focused journey of more than 25 years, if there's one learning that you really, really, really want people to get and to see and to highlight, what would that be right now in this moment?
So I think it comes down to how we listen. And there's the constructive part in terms of what we listen for and what we're most interested in, and that we don't lose track of those important, useful things, the strengths, etc. But even more basic than that, it's about mindfulness. And the first time I heard, it was Insu, talk about mindfulness in our work, I didn't even know what it was, right? I mean, now, you know, it's really infused in a lot of the work that we do, and that's wonderful. And, you know, many people are teaching clients mindfulness practice. I think it's useful for everyone. We should teach it in school. But I thought it meant concentrating really hard. I had it exactly backwards. And then she sort of enlightened me about what she meant. And I did some reading and some practicing. And then I had this little experience of my own that helps me to remember how important it is to be mindful. So it was when, after many years of absolute misery, I finally had finished my PhD. And my children had lived with my PhD hanging over their heads for a very long time. You know, why can't we go to the zoo today? She's working on her PhD. Why is she in such a bad mood? She's working on her PhD. And they were really glad it was over. Then they wondered, well, like, what is it anyway? Like, what does it mean to have a PhD? And so their dad informed them it meant that I was now full of knowledge. I was listening to this and I thought, oh, that's me. Ooh. Full of knowledge. Wow. I was quite pleased with myself. He then went on to explain the obvious side effect of being full of knowledge. You're full, right? You can never learn anything else. You're done. Finished. That's it for you. And I think it's a real risk, right? That I can be so full of what I know or what I think I know that there is no room for me to take in anything about the world, the view, the hopes, the wants of the person I'm talking to. And so, you know, it's just for me a reminder, I need to practice ways of having a quiet mind so that I can be present. And we all need to have our ways, and they're different. We all have different tricks. I like breathing. Breathing is good. Also, I have an invisible button I can push, and I get a recording of my grandmother's voice, which is very soothing to me. And it says, "Dear, just be still."
Wow.
What a beautiful end of our podcast. Wow.
Before we come to the very end, Heather, we'd love to invite you to give a challenge of the week to our listeners.
Okay. So this is a simple one, I think, I hope, something I practice. Because I sort of have two hats, you know, I have my solution-focused hat and my solution-focused world, which I love. And then I have my suicide prevention hat and world, which I also love. But, you know, there's Brigitte and now all these people in Quebec that she has trained. It's so amazing. But not so many solution-focused practitioners in that world yet. I'm growing.
Brigitte is Brigitte Lavoie, and she was on our podcast in episode number 25. So if you want to listen to that, please do that.
So I'm often going into meetings, for example, working with people with whom we have very different views. And so one of the things that I practice is just trying to find some common ground. So especially if I can do it in the moment, but for me, if I know I'm going into that situation, then it's really helpful for me to just stop and think before I go in about what the common ground is. And sometimes it's something small and personal, you know, like we're both grandparents, or we come from the East Coast, or, you know, we love to eat sushi. I mean, whatever. But more often we have these good intentions for clients and these hopes and, you know, and once I get going, I can actually come up with a lot of things. So just practice before you go into a meeting or a conversation, just thinking about what is the common ground I share with the people I'm going to be talking to.
Wow, what a beautiful challenge we are into.
Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
And a big thank you for hosting us this week. And it's just so lovely to be here. And I can't wait to be here again for a writing retreat with you.
No pressure.
One of Heather's...
I look forward to that too.
One of Heather's future encounters, having a writing retreat here, the beautiful spot here at Conrad Beach in Lawrencetown.
In Nova Scotia.
Yes.
A solution-focused writing retreat.
Yes. We talked in the podcast about a webinar with Heather and Brigitte Lavoie we had last week on Sunday. And for all those who are interested in that, there is a recording about that. And there's also a conversation with Heather and Brigitte about hope and reasons for living. So you're invited to come and join this program and re-listen the webinar and the video conversation. I'd be very excited about that too. Have you seen that? And you can go on www.sfontour.com/resources/free-webinar.
Or you can find everything we talked about in our resource section of this podcast. Just go to www.sfontour.com/simplyfocuspodcast and then go to episode 27. And if you have not yet done, please subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Blueberry, or soon on Spotify.
Please also comment in the comment field of our podcast section. Share with us what you liked about this podcast, what inspired you, and get in contact with us. So Heather, Dominic, and I would love to hear from you what you liked, what inspired you, and also how the challenge of the week worked for you. So thank you very much for that.
And thank you very much, Heather, for this inspiring talk. Thank you very much for supporting Elfie's birthday project and just for having us here. We're having such a beautiful and wonderful time here.
So much fun.
Thank you.
And goodbye.